Welcome to our Goldster Podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're looking at the ever-popular genre of crime writing. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Goldster Author to Author special event. I'm absolutely thrilled to have Ellie Griffiths back. Now, you might be thinking, that's not Ellie Griffiths. She's got a different name. This is her real name. And I don't know if you want to be called Domenica or do you want to be called Ellie?
I'm going to rename myself on screen, Lucinda, but either's fine.
Okay. Well, I think most people know you as Ellie, so I think we're going to stick with Ellie for this evening. And I'm really thrilled to welcome back Ellie Griffiths, who is, as all my Goldster members know, one of my favourite authors, and she was an early guest on the Goldster Inside Story, and she's come back today for a very special reason, A, because she's got about a million new books herself out, but also because tomorrow is Agatha Christie's birthday, and Ellie has written a new story as part of a new Agatha Christie collection, which we'll get onto, and we're here to celebrate the eve of Dame Agatha's birthday in the Goldster Agatha Christie month. So welcome, everybody, and welcome, Ellie. It's really good to see you back here again.
Oh, thank you for asking me. It's lovely to be back.
Now, you have a huge number of books that seem to come out all the time, and am I right, you've got three new ones right now? We'll go into detail later.
I guess, in a way, yeah. So I've got the Agatha Christie collection, which I know we're going to talk about, the Miss Marple collection. I've got a copy of it there.
Coveted. Wonderful.
Well, look at this. This is really cool, because all the contributors, their signatures are there on the inside. Isn't that lovely?
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, and Agatha Christie's in the middle, of course. So there's that. And then at the end of the month, I've got, end of this month, I've got a new standalone called Bleeding Heart Yard. Yes. And, of course, it's not long since the Locked Room came out. So that kind of counts as three, doesn't it?
And haven't you, isn't the Midnight Hour quite new as well?
Yes, it is. It was out in paperback quite recently. Yes, yes. Definitely. Thank you. You're keeping up better than me.
An astonishing number of new books coming out. So just tell us a little bit about what it's like right now when you've got all these new books coming out. How do you cope with keeping the kind of work-life balance and trying to remember which series you're talking about and which book you're supposed to be discussing?
It's quite, well, you know this, it's quite an anxious time, I think, before you have a book out, because you go through so many stages of the book, don't you? You get to the stage where you think, you start it, you think, oh my goodness, this is so good, you know, wow, why didn't anyone else think of this brilliant idea? Then after about, usually for me, it's about sort of chapter five, I start thinking, oh, how terrible, why would anyone want to read this? Oh no. But then you get a sort of burst of energy at the end and you finish it and you send it off and you think, hooray, I finished it, I'm wonderful. Then you think, oh no, what does my editor think? And if your editor likes it, then that's okay. And then you see the cover, it looks great, but then just before it actually comes out and real readers read it, you think, oh no, what if it's terrible? So you do go through, you know, and I know you know this is why, you go through all these sort of phases, don't you? And the good thing about the Marple collection is, what it is just very quickly to tell people, it's 12 new stories by contemporary women crime writers. So there's me, Val McDermott, Ruth Ware, Naomi Alderman, Judith A. Mitchell, who have written a new story with Miss Marple as a character in it. And the good thing about that is kind of shared, you know, so it's nice when the book comes out, it's a joint thing, so you don't feel all the responsibility of the new book. So actually it's been really fun doing that, I have to say.
And what was it like being commissioned? Did they come to you and say, we're doing a collection, you've got to write in the style of Agatha Christie? Were you part of the ideas process? What happened?
It was really funny, actually, really strange, because they approached my agent and they said, you know, would Ellie like to do a Miss Marple story? And she asked me, and I thought she was joking. I thought, what? A Miss Marple story? You know, what do you... I honestly did, and she sort of said to Mother, well, why would I joke about it? But I just honestly thought that it might be a joke. And I was like, yeah, why not? I'll be, you know, Sherlock Holmes next week. Why not? I didn't say that. Luckily I said. So, and then because it was the Agatha Christie estate had the ideas. So, and their publishers are HarperCollins, who I actually used to work for years and years ago as an editor. So I actually know a few people who are involved on that side. So the Agatha Christie estate and HarperCollins then had a Zoom meeting with us all. And it was very nice and also a little bit sort of intimidating to see Val McDermott there on the screen, Naomi Alderman, all these great names, quite a few American writers as well who I didn't know who were all fantastic. And they were quite, they had some constrictions. So you had to write about Miss Marple during the years that Agatha Christie wrote about it. You couldn't do her young, which would be quite fun, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, it would be.
You know, Jane, the early years, that would be really fun. But then you couldn't do that. And you couldn't do her sort of after Agatha Christie died in 1976, I think. So you couldn't. So you had a sort of period, it was sort of roughly between the 1920 and 1970, I guess. So you could write, you had to write in that time. She couldn't meet Poirot.
Oh, what a pity. Is that what you wanted to do?
That idea gone, isn't it? And she couldn't fall in love.
Oh.
There was no love interest, which I can sort of see, because I think if you introduce that in a short story, that's all it would be, really. Yeah. So I can sort of see that. And another little thing they said, I think just they had this idea that each story had to include some kind of either flower or vegetable thing. And it had to slightly echo one of the original stories. So, but after that, there were no restrictions, and they didn't say write in Christie style. And I quickly thought that I would write, because quite a lot of the Miss Marple stories, well, all of them, Miss Marple never speaks in the first person. She never says, I think I did this, and nor does Poirot. And quite often, the stories are told first person from a different character, and is almost always a man. She almost always writes. So you think of Murder at the Vicarage, is first person from the vicar, who actually is quite an interesting character with his, you know, rather passionate marriage and, you know, all these issues going on. It's quite an interesting thing. So I thought I would write first person point of view of a man, a writer, who goes to a house in Italy, and I'd called it the Villa Rosa, so that was my flower thing done. But also, as you said at the beginning, my real name is Domenica De Rosa, so it was a sort of hint to my name. So it's a writer who goes to a beautiful hotel in Italy, planning, in fact, to commit a murder, and then there's all this group of people there, including a sort of an elderly lady in a tweed suit who's Miss Marple, who always knows exactly what's happening. But the hotel, And this is where I slightly took my inspiration from at Bertram's Hotel. It's not quite what it seems, and the people are quite what they seem.
Oh, I love at Bertram's Hotel.
I do too.
Read this. I've got this arriving tomorrow, and I can't read it.
I do hope you like it. But what is fun is they're so different. So you start off with Lucy Foley's, which is quite traditional. It's at St. Mary's Mead, and it's great. But the second one is by American writer, I think it's Alyssa Cole. And it's Miss Marple Takes Manhattan. And you're like, whoa,
fantastic.
She's in Times Square, you know. But, you know, although that sounds sort of wow, you know, Lisa's totally read all the books and is very recognisably Miss Marple, just in Times Square. So I absolutely loved that. There's another one where she does Tai Chi, which I also loved. I don't know what the purists will think about it, but I loved that.
But so did you get to read them all quite far in advance? Did you not read any of them until you'd finished yours? How did
you know? Didn't read any until I finished mine. And then we got sort of an early thing where we read through them. And actually, I think mine is a little different from the others because I have taken this approach of writing it. And it's mine is sort of a little bit about being a writer. And it's a little bit about being a writer of a long series, because I know that Agatha Christie was interested in that. Of course, she created the character of Ariadne Oliver, who is a writer who, like my writer in the book, starts to hate his main character. So that was the thing. So the book's just called Marple, which I fail. The only thing is that it's the only thing I think Miss Marple wouldn't like. She'd hate to be called Marple, wouldn't she?
She would, wouldn't she? Yes.
Yeah, wouldn't she? but yeah, so it's out tomorrow. Out tomorrow, which is Agatha Christie's birthday. And I'm going to show you
We've had a question, and I'm going to put it. This is a link to buying it in the chat.
Oh, wonderful! I'm just going to show you though. Just bear with me for half a second.
Of course.
This is just in my little writing chair, because this is interesting. So this is it. But this is the American edition, and it's so different.
Oh, wow, yes. Gosh. completely different. I wouldn't have thought that was the same book at all.
Yes, it's really interesting, I think.
Wow, that's really fascinating. So when you were asked to do it, did you have to start reading Miss Marple again? I mean, are you a mad keen Agatha Christie fan and you read them all the time anyway? Or had you not read them for years? And what did you think about when you were writing it? Did you feel that you were channeling Christie, or did you feel like a bit of a pretender or what?
Well, I am a big Agatha Christie fan, but it's also true that I hadn't read them for quite a long time. And I, when I was 11, I wrote my first book, first novella, I guess. But it was called The Hair of the Dog, which must have been something my parents talked about. I don't know. But it was very Agatha Christie-ish. So I think I started reading them about that time, sort of, you know, 11, 12, 13. I was very keen on reading them. And I've read them, you know, intermittently. But yes, so the first thing that I did, and the Agatha Christie estate were really great. They sent us all the books. All the Miss Marple books, and I did just read them all. And you do forget stuff, and I really enjoyed them. There are a couple of moments you think, oh, okay. But really, you know, you forget things about her, and you forget the fact that she's quite a... I thought it's sort of really almost a terrifying character, because she says at one point she's Nemesis in a pink shawl. You know, she is so, you know, she is this woman who's sort of overlooked, and that's all true, and sitting there with her knitting. But she's terribly strong character, and I found that really, really interesting. So I, as I said, didn't try and write like Agatha Christie, but I did want to get an Agatha Christie-ish plot. And I also wanted to get a few really Agatha-ish clues. And one of the things I love is the way she often has a clue in a name. You know, like yes. there's the book that has Joe Green, and it's really Giuseppe Verdi.
Of course, yeah.
So I did get, I hope people agree, quite a good name clue in this book, an Italian name too.
Oh, I'm going to be looking at that now.
I was quite pleased with myself because I love that. You know, things like... I actually think this is a Secret Seven story, sorry, by Enid Blyton, but they're looking for a character, I think it's called Alexandra Grove. And it's actually a place, you know, and I love that sort of clue. So I tried to do a clue a bit like that.
And what was it like writing? I know you've written some short stories before, but mostly you write full-length novels. I mean, I find it a very, very different art. Personally, I find short stories really quite hard. Do you find that the same, or do you find them easier? Do you
like? I completely agree with you. I was going to ask you what you thought about that. I know you've done a few short stories, haven't you?
Yes.
Somebody said, and I don't know who it was who said it, I didn't have time to write a long story, so I wrote a short one. And it almost does take more time, doesn't it? Because you have to really condense it, and you have to make sure it all works. And especially to have a sort of convincing mystery in a short story. I did find it really hard, yes.
That's what I would have thought, because, you know, so much of the plotting for a detective novel, it just takes a while to build it up, to put those little clues and the things that people don't realise are clues until the end. And to try and get that into a short story, I mean, how many words were you, what was your maximum you were allowed to do?
I think it was between 5,000 and 8,000, and nearly everyone went for the 8,000. I think mine is one of the shorter ones, actually. It's not quite, it's not 5,000. So yes, everyone went a little bit. But of course, Agatha Christie did herself lots of short stories and lots of really good plots in them. So she was really good at it. And I did find it quite hard, but it's quite a fun challenge, really, isn't it? To condense everything down. And every word matters, doesn't it? Which is great.
And did your editor, was it a new editor for you? So did you work very closely with them?
Yeah, so it was a new editor, because it was my publishers who published all my Ellie Griffiths books, Quercus, and this was HarperCollins. So yeah, so it was great. It was lovely to work with a new editor. But also, the editor sort of in charge of all the Agatha Christie books is a guy called David Braun, who I knew really well from my HarperCollins days. It's been lovely to work with him again. He's just the nicest guy. So he is he has this great job, I think. And he's basically the editor in charge of all the dead authors. So he does Agatha Christie, he does Tolkien, he does C.S. Lewis. And he's a bit like an elf, because genuinely he hasn't aged at all since when I worked with him. But he's just the nicest person, one of those people who has all this knowledge, and just in a very gentle way. He never makes you feel like you don't have the knowledge.
Brilliant, because he's coming on to Goldster, actually, this month. He's going to be in Humphrey.
People really like him, because he's just the nicest guy, honestly. He is. And well, so
who we had on earlier was Martin Edwards, who was full of admiration for you. He and he said he loved your short story in this collection. It was the one he actually highlighted. So
I'm so pleased, because you know Martin is another one who has all this knowledge and
amazing knowledge.
I could listen to him forever, couldn't you? He just knows everything. And you say to him, I don't think Miss Marple's ever eaten a sandwich. And he says, well, actually, in murder in Mesopotamia, you know, he doesn't say it like that. He just does know, doesn't he? He's incredible. And his knowledge of the Golden Age is just incredible. Yeah. He's just, again, a really nice person.
So when you were younger and you were reading Agatha Christie, is that what inspired you to start writing crime, do you think? Or was it just, because I know you wrote more romance and kind of standalone novels before you became a kind of crime novel author. What do you think it was? Was it Miss Marple? Was it Poirot? Or was it something completely different?
I think it was actually Agatha Christie, really. And I think it's quite significant that my first ever attempt at writing anything long was this crime novel. And actually, it had quite a good plot. I was looking, as I've only got the beginning of it, so I can't even remember who did it, but it's about a group of young people who live in a little village, which is based in Rottingdean, which is kind of near where I live now. And nothing ever happens in the village. So they decide to stage a fake murder. So the media will come. But of course, it turns into a real murder, which I think is quite a good plot.
You should write that. Are you planning to write that up?
I wonder if I should write it just as a short story or something. Anyhow, so I think it really was influenced by those. I read lots of Agatha Christie. My mum had Dorothy L. Sayers, Marjorie Alling, and those sort of people as well. Also a writer that I'm really fond of. I don't know if you've come across Lucinda. Do you like Nancy Spain?
I've only recently discovered Nancy Spain, actually. Yes, and it was somebody I hadn't heard of till about a year ago.
She's a really interesting writer, but from that golden age as well. And she wrote things called Cinderella Goes to the Morgue, which is just the best book about pantomime you're ever going to read. And there's one called Poison for Teacher. And I read a book when I was sort of youngish called R in the Month, which is one of her books. And that had quite a big influence on me as well. So I think I was probably reading at the same time Georgia Eyre and Agatha Christie. And that is why I wrote crime and romance, really.
And did you read Georgia Heyer's romances as well? Detective fiction as
Yes. I mean, they're probably not as good, I don't think, as the romances, but they're very charming and lovely and have some good jokes in them as well. So they're worth reading.
They are. I love, when I was a teenager, I read the detective ones by Georgia Heyer again and again. I just love them. We've got a comment here saying, you have to write stroke finish Hair of the Dog, please.
Okay.
And you do write for children, don't you? Or young adults as well, don't you?
Yeah, yes, I do. So I've written this series of books for sort of, they call it middle grade, which is a sort of woolly area to me. So sort of 8+. But I tend to sort of say 8 to 108 because I do hope anyone enjoy them. And this is one of them. And it's they're set in the 1930s in a girls' boarding school. And the main character is called Justice Jones. And she is the daughter of a barrister. And her mother was a detective story writer. And she's going to boarding school for the very first time. And she's in the taxi going there. And she says to the taxi driver, would you come here often? And he says, no, but my brother was here. I don't know why I'm doing this voice. No, but my brother was here last week. And she says, oh, is he a taxi driver too? And he says, no, he's an undertaker. So you know there's been a death at the school and it turns out to be a murder. So I had super fun with those, I have to say, because they're also slightly based on my mum, who was at boarding school in the 1930s and was the child of an actor and had this sort of slightly unusual childhood. So if you have children or grandchildren who might like them, the Girl Called Justice series.
I've just put the link to the first one in the chat for everybody there.
So, you're so efficient. How do you do these things?
Well, I was worried that you can hear my typing away when I'm trying to find it online. So I thought I should have muted myself actually, but I didn't. So sorry if you could hear the click, click.
Not at all, no.
So tell us about, let's move on to your other work. Tell us about Bleeding Heart Yard. What is this about? And did you enjoy writing it?
Yes, I loved writing it. So this is, I'm calling it a standalone in a way, but it's also the third book to feature Harbinder Kaur, who is the detective in Stranger Diaries and The Postscript Murders. And in this book, Harbinder has been promoted and she's moved to London. And the first thing that she, first case she has to solve is a case of a Conservative MP who's been found dead at his school reunion. And he went to one of these kind of trendy comprehensive schools, and they're having a big reunion, and he's found dead there. So, but there seems to be a link to some strange clandestine meetings that he had in a real place, as you will know, called Bleeding Heart Yard.
Very Dickensian.
In Verity, it comes into Little Dorrit, doesn't it?
You know, it does, yeah.
It's a really, it's actually, sadly, if you go there, there is a nice restaurant, but it's not quite as Dickensian as it sounds, is it? It's a bit sort of, you know, it's just kind of offices.
Gentrified.
I mean, it is a bit gentrified, yes, but it's cobbled. It's still cobbled. And there was, in the 1700s, a real-life murder there, where and a heart was found in the centre of the yard, so people think that might be where it got its name. So everything leads back to this particular place called Bleeding Heart Yards and these particular meetings. So it was great fun to write. So I was born in London and lived in London till I was five. My parents moved down to Brighton. So, and I was also at university in London and lived there quite a lot. So it was great to write about London, and particularly as well in the parts of London, like Barlby Road is one of them in West Kensington, where my Italian family, for some reason, had several. So my grandparents lived there. My aunt and uncle lived there. Various cousins all lived in this one road. So it's been really fun to sort of go back, and also to go back into some of the, as you say, slightly Dickensian sort of corners of London, and you know, the graveyards and things like that. So I really did enjoy writing it.
So this is, as you say, the third novel to feature Harbinder Kaur. How did Harbinder come about? How did you decide you were going to write about her? Did she appear like Ruth? I remember you saying last time that Ruth just kind of suddenly appeared to you. Did the same thing happen with her, or was she kind of a composite of something else?
Well remembered about Ruth appearing out of the mist. I think I was a bit embarrassed to say that to you, but yeah, she did sort of appear. Yeah, sort of. So the Stranger Diaries was my first sort of standalone. So I wanted to write a kind of gothic, a modern day gothic horror novel. And I knew that I would need a detective. But like a lot of things, I didn't know that that detective would be Harbinder almost until she came on the scene, and she sort of came in, and I thought, oh yeah, no, I like writing about her. And I think she's probably there. There's one friend of mine who is a bit in my mind when I write about her, so she's probably linked to some real people. But she is she's a detective. She's from a British Indian family. They're Sikhs. She's gay. She lives at home with her parents. She's not quite out to them in the first book, but she is now. And she's just a very sort of sardonic person, and she's not easily cowed, and it's lots of fun to write about her. She's the sort of person who comes onto the scene and says, let's assume I'm in charge, you know, and although, and I would be quite surprised, because she is a bit prickly as well, and in the first book she kind of takes against the other main character, Claire, for quite a lot of the book, and I thought people wouldn't like her much, but people did really like her, which is brilliant. And so she turns up again in still sardonic in Postscript Murders, and here she is in London on her first big case. But they're three main narrators. So there's Harbinder, there's Cassie, who's actually a member of her team who has a secret of her own, and there's Anna, one of the other people at the reunion. So that was fun too to change it
and
around.
When is this one out? This is out very soon, isn't it?
It is 29th of September, so the end of the month. I don't think I have, funnily enough, I have the American cover. So the British cover is very different, but that's the American cover, Bleeding Heart.
Yeah. Oh, it is very different. Posted the link, everybody, so you can see the cover, the British cover. Yes, it's fascinating. Do they change your titles? I remember Ian Rankin talking about how they always change his titles in America, and then he gets disgruntled emails from Americans saying, I've been to Edinburgh and I can't find Flesh Market Alley. And he says, well, that's because it's actually called Flesh Market Close, but the American publishers insisted no one would understand that name, so they changed it. Do they do that with yours or not?
How interesting, because also Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone is called something else, isn't it? Or is it called?
Oh, I think you're right. Yes, I think it does have a different name. And they don't do that with yours.
No, I haven't had that. I haven't had that at all. They've always gone with our title. Then the only one she's really strange is Dying Fall. In America, it's called A Dying Fall. I don't know why they kept the A in it, but I sometimes, I sometimes have the thing that Ian Rankin mentions, because Dying Fall was right towards the end called, I was going to call it The Tomb of the Raven King. And so there's a little bit in the back of one of my books that mentions the Tomb of the Raven King, and people do still write to me saying, oh, I haven't read this. Where's that gone? It's like a missing...
Oh, frustrating.
Like, you know, it's like Love's Labour's One, you know, though I'm not waiting myself for Shakespeare. But, you know, it is like that missing book, but actually it just became Dying Fall at a late stage.
Yeah. So one of your other new books, okay, The Midnight Hour, tell us about the Brighton series. So this has just come out in paperback.
Yes.
So you're thinking this is a really old book. It's been out for ages, but it's just come out in paperback. I'm just going to put the link to it. And tell us about the Brighton Mysteries.
Well, these are really, I love writing them. So the first one is called The Zigzag Girl, and they're set in the 1950s. And they're set in the kind of theatrical world of the 1950s. And they're really the last days of variety, which is sort of what musical became. So it's the last days of that sort of life. And it's really close to my heart because my granddad was a variety performer. He was a comedian. He'd served in the First World War as a pilot. And after that, he'd said to my mum once, after everything I saw in the war, there's only one job I could do, and that was to become a comedian. And that's what he did.
Wow.
He travelled around. So he would be like, he would be in Scarborough one week, and then he'd be in Glasgow, and then he'd be in Eastbourne. Different theatre every week, really. And until she was 11, my mum went with him because she was a single parent. So travelled around with him. So I wanted to write about this world. So The Zigzag Girl starts in 1950, where a body is found cut into three, which I quickly say it isn't gruesome because I don't like writing, but it is gruesome, but I don't go into much gruesome detail.
You don't do gore, no, which I always appreciate.
I just don't like reading that gruesome. Yeah. I write them, but it reminds the detective of a magic trick called The Zigzag Girl, you know, where there's a cabinet and there's, I'm afraid it almost is a girl inside, and the swords go through and you pull out the middle bit and it makes that zigzag shape. So, and he contacts his old army friend, Max Mephisto, who's a famous magician, and they solve the case together. So the good thing, the really fun thing, I don't know if you think this as well, about writing about the past, is you can kind of leap forward. So this was that book set in 1950, and The Midnight Hour, which has just come out, is set in 1965. So I've been able to sort of whiz through the years a little bit.
Brilliant.
And things have changed quite a lot. But The Midnight Hour is set in Rottingdean again, which is, funnily enough, I hadn't really thought about that till that where The Hair of the Dog was set. It's set in Rottingdean.
All aligning.
And I don't know if anyone listening knows Rottingdean. Or if you, do you know it, Miss Cinder?
Not really. I mean, I've been there, but I couldn't say I know it well. Yeah.
It's really well worth visiting because it's absolutely, it's beautiful little village. And it's one of those villages that's so beautiful, it's almost a bit sinister because it has like the village green and a pond, a beautiful old church. Rudyard Kipling lived there, Burne Jones lived there. But behind the church, there's a building and it's called Tudor Close. And it's one of those Tudor buildings that's so... It's not really Tudor. It's built in the 1920s, but it's so Tudor as to be over the top. You know, it's full of beams and stained glass, little twisty bits of beam. But in the 1920s and 1930s, it was a hotel. And strangely enough, it was really, really popular with Hollywood. So Betty Davis stayed there. Julie Andrews sang there for the first time. All sorts of Hollywood greats stayed there. And it was also quite famous for its musical interludes. So they had these musical evenings there. And the pianist there was a guy called Edward Pratt, I think. And he was sitting there playing the piano one evening. And he looked round at Tudor Close. And he looked round at he thought about the house. He thought about the ballroom and the conservatory and the billiard room. And he thought, what if I created a board game based on this house? About a murder mystery set in a house.
And he
created this game and he called it Murder at Tudor Close. But then it was bought by Waddington and they changed it to Cluedo, obviously.
Fantastic. Now I've got to go there.
So now Cluedo started in this house. So my book starts when... But after the 30s, this hotel became private homes, several of them. So the Midnight Hour starts when a theatrical impresario called Bert Billington is found dead in his home in Tudor Close. So there is a real murder in Tudor Close. And it's investigated by the team from the previous books. But of course, now it's 1965 and women's liberation is calling from across the Atlantic. And Bert Billington's wife, Verity, who is an old musical star herself, she will only talk to women detectives. So that's
oh, fantastic. Excellent. Smart.
She's been reading Betty Friedan, so she has. So it's fun to write about that changing world. You know, there's now television and film and the variety. The old variety is dead, really, but the characters live on, and there are certainly links. This impresario is not a very nice person, and he has secrets in his past. So that is The Midnight Hour, which came out that year. That film, that song came out that year, The Midnight
Hour. Wow. Oh, that all sounds brilliant. I'm really looking forward to reading that one.
I think I'm
up to date with at least five. Maybe I haven't read the sixth yet. But yes. Great. So that's good to have a new one. And then, of course, we're going to get on to The Locked Room. I've just put that in the chat as well. So your most recent Ruth Galloway book, and you've been writing another one, haven't you? Tell us about Ruth for anyone who hasn't discovered Ruth yet.
So this, The Locked Room, is the 14th book about Dr. Ruth Galloway. And Ruth is a forensic archaeologist, it's a real job. And they're archaeologists who are quite often, they quite often help the police when they find, consulted by the police, particularly when they find buried bones, because they know how to sort of date bones or to work how they came to be buried. So she's a forensic archaeologist, and she works at a made-up university in Norfolk, and she lives on her own at the start of the book, or with her cats, in a beautiful but quite lonely part of the Norfolk coast. And in the first book, she is consulted by DCI Harry Nelson, who finds, because some bones have been buried on the marshland near Ruth's house. There'll be no spoilers, don't worry, did you see something coming
up? No spoilers, please.
There'll be no spoilers, don't worry. Partly because I can't really remember. No, that's not true.
Well, lucky you, Shazza, because you've got an awful lot of great books to come. So
there aren't any spoilers. But I'll just tell you sort of the idea for the books came from this whole idea of marshland, because my husband Andy's an archaeologist and we were on holiday in Norfolk. And he happened to say that prehistoric people thought marshland was sacred because it's neither land nor sea. They thought of it as a bridge to the afterlife, neither land nor sea, neither life nor death, like it was a liminal space, an in-between place. And that's why you find bodies buried there, really, so-called bog bodies. So that gave me the idea for the book. And as I said to you last time I came on here, Lucinda, I saw Ruth walking towards me out of the mist. So that's really where that idea came from. So now we're at book 14. And with no spoilers, it's just all very, very complicated. But basically, I'd written a book about Ruth every year for the last 14 years, and I've just written book 15. But I knew that by the time this book came, so the years have basically followed, you know, real life. So it's a real life event that's happened. You know, Donald Trump became president, Brexit happened. I mean, didn't go into these things in detail, but they did happen. So I knew that this book would be 2020. And I had to decide whether or not I would do lockdown and COVID, really. And I thought about it a lot. And I know every writer who writes kind of, you know, in the present day, in the contemporary world, will have thought about whether to do lockdown or not. And I can totally see arguments for and against. But I read somewhere that there are almost no contemporary fictional accounts of the Spanish flu in 1918 to 19. Almost no fiction writers wrote about it. Though obviously quite a lot wrote about the First World War, but and people have written about it since. But at the time, no one wrote about it. And I thought this was really interesting. And I also thought it would be a shame if nobody wrote about it. So I thought to myself, because I'd written a book every year about Ruth for the last 14 years, it sort of felt wrong to miss it out. So in this book, it starts off with DCI Nelson, who, for those who don't know, is the policeman who usually works with Ruth and has a very complicated relationship with her. He's at the start of the book, he's saying, oh, stuff and nonsense, all this hand sanitizer, what a load of old rubbish. But then lockdown comes. And it was really, for me, quite grueling, actually, to remember that. So Ruth is locked down with her daughter, Kate, in her lonely cottage on the salt marsh. And Nelson is locked down somewhere else. And, you know, they can't see each other, but they do know that there is possibly a serial killer around. So it's lucky that Ruth has got a nice new neighbour.
And when I read it, it was really interesting because, you know, it seems very recent lockdown and everything. And actually, it took me back to things I'd forgotten about at the beginning, because we've become much more blasé, and since the vaccines, we don't have to worry so much, et cetera, et cetera. And it was really interesting because, as you say, I think I heard one author on the radio saying, I couldn't write a lockdown novel because everybody's sick of it. But actually, when I read yours, I thought, I'm really glad this is documented, because I often think the same with going back to the Golden Age. The documentation of social history, I think, is almost more accurate in crime fiction than in any other genre of writing.
That's so true, actually. I think that's such a good point, actually, Lucinda, because it is because crime fiction kind of ranges across, you know, society as well. You do get I did think maybe people would be fed up about it, but it just did feel, looking back on it, I would feel that I'd missed, you know.
Yeah, I don't think you could have missed it out.
I don't think I could have, and sort of I felt I would have regretted missing out. But isn't it strange, because time has done something very weird, I think, since lockdown, because it seems such a long time ago, doesn't it?
Isn't very long.
And it's only 2 years ago. And I keep a diary, and I've kept a diary since the old days of The Hair of the Dog. I did start that when I was 11 too. Oh, interesting.
Wow.
Yeah. So I keep a diary, and I had to look back on my diary just to see things. And I'd even kept a record of, you know, what Boris Johnson's hair was doing on various days, and, you know, what the government said and things like that.
Yeah, and it does come out, really, really comes in to the book, and it reminded me of things in an almost slightly claustrophobic way of, oh, God, I remember feeling like that when I heard that particular announcement. Now, we've got a few comments here. Love the Ruth Galloway books.
Thank you.
So thank you for that. And I know there's quite a few people here who like them. We've got a comment or question. Is this ever going to be a TV series, please, in capital letters?
Oh, well, it would be nice, wouldn't it? I have to say, I mean, like a lot of writers, I've had interest from TV people. I think four times the series has been optioned. So that means like a company is interested in doing it, and they pay a certain amount of money, and they go off and develop it. And so that's happened four times, and there've been some really good scripts and some really interesting, but it just has never happened. It's always just at the last moment hasn't got there. And TV is an awful world, isn't it, Lucinda? It's kind of
like, really is. It's just, I know I do regular TV ideas, and you think you're getting there, and then it just doesn't happen. It's absolutely bizarre.
And everyone's so enthusiastic at first, aren't they? And you think, oh, this is good. And then it doesn't happen.
But you just look at TV, I look at the Radio Times or whatever, and I think there's literally not one thing I want to watch. And I would love to watch it. My only fear if they did your books is they'd make them too gory. Because as you say, you don't write gore, but there's a lot implied. And TV directors do love to give you the whole blood and guts thing. Sometimes I remember reading one of your books thinking, I don't know if I could watch this on TV.
That's another interesting point. Yes, I think they do, though. Recently, I think there've been a couple of things where I've thought, oh, that's nice. They have slightly rowed back on that, because one thing that I absolutely hate is when you see sort of dead women and that sort of focus on them. But there was a really, I think it was called Show Trial, and there was a series about a woman student who her body was brought up from the river. And what they did was they just had her sleeping bag, and just seeing the sleeping bag sodden like that was so much, I think, so much better than showing her body, and actually just as shocking. So I hope they're getting a bit better, but who knows? Oh, there's a little cat, not my cat. Sadly, my cat is no longer with us, but what a sweetie. I think it's my neighbour's cat. I think he's good figure.
Wants to be in your next book, you see.
Isn't he? Well, hanging there, I don't know if people can see, there's a selection of hag stones, you know, those stones with holes in them that are meant to be lucky. And little Tigger is...
We talk about animals a lot. Ruth has cats. I know that you, until very recently, had a much loved cat. Nelson, of course, has a dog. Max has a dog. There's lots of different animals who come in. Cathbad has a dog. Various of your characters. What do animals mean for you in books? Do you think that you give them kind of the traits that you would like your characters to have, or do they mean something to you when you're writing them?
I really love animals. That's really why. I love animals. I love writing about them. My editor, I've had the same editor for all the Ellie Griffiths books, in fact. because, as you know, I wrote 4 books under my own name first, but all the Ellie Griffiths books, and I think 26 of them now, all been edited by the same editor, which is really unusual. And I've been so lucky because she's just wonderful. But one of the things she does disagree about is if I start anthropomorphizing the animals too much. And I would say, look, there's Tigger looking quizzical. And Jane will say in the margins, no, he isn't. He's a cat.
So, take it she's not an animal lover.
I think she'd like some, but I don't think she has one. So she and it's quite a good job, actually, Miss Cindy, because otherwise I would just go on about the animals way too much. But actually, there are interesting reasons for writing about animals, because if you're writing a crime novel, animals, as we know, have senses that are on a different level than ours, and you can raise the tension a bit by having a, you know, a dog looking past you. And if you think of The Woman in Black, the role the dog, little spider, plays in that, you know, it's so important. So you can have that, and also your character can show their humanity or lack of it by the way they treat animals. I think we think about people in a different way if they like animals, but sometimes you can use that as a bit of misdirection because, this person loves this cat, there can't be anything wrong with them.
You always know in Dickens if someone's a villain if they're mean to animals.
Yes.
Know that this is it.
And that's not bad, you know, not a bad way of telling whether people are horrible. But of course, some pretty horrible people, you know, like some Dennis Nielsen and Hitler, their dogs, didn't they? So, I think there are lots of reasons for writing about animals, but I just really love animals and I like writing about them, and I do like imagining what I'm a huge keen on horses, actually. I rode a lot as a child and love writing about them, but the horses have only come into one Ruth book, so one book's gonna have to have a horse in it.
Well, we've got quite a few comments here. Somebody's written, everyone had a point of view in the first book I ever wrote, even the dog.
I like that. Well, that's great. And, you know, William Shaw, who's a really terrific crime hunter, listened, has he been on your show?
No, not at all.
He'd be a great guest. So, good friend of mine, crime writer, lives in Brighton. And yeah, he wrote a crime novel that has a point of view from a badger.
Excellent. Oh, that sounds brilliant. We have to get him on.
Yes. Get on to talk about the badger.
We've got a comment saying the animals always know. They do.
They do know. And sometimes, you know, there have been cases, I think there was a case where a parrot actually told the police who did it. So sometimes they really do have to.
Parrots probably can as well.
Yeah, they could.
Comment here, we were talking about gore on TV. Agatha Christie's Hewson on All Four was really good, not too much gore. I haven't had a chance to watch that yet, so thank you for that, because I was hoping it wouldn't be.
Is the question, I'm sure the questioner knows, but is that Ariadne Oliver's finished attempt?
It is, yes.
Because I love that. And that was quite an influence on my short stories, the fact that Ariadne Oliver creates this Finnish detective, that early Scandi Noir, really, and then doesn't know anything about Finland, which I just think is really funny.
And she always says, why is I making a vegetarian? Infuriating man.
Yes.
But that's really Agatha Christie's relationship with Poirot, isn't it?
So it is, yes.
Have you ever had that? Have you ever had a character you just couldn't stand but your readers loved? Please don't tell me Ruth.
No, I haven't. But I do slightly understand. And of course, it's a wonderful compliment of people like your characters and feel like they know them. But I have had cases where you feel a bit like your readers, you know, want your characters to do something that you don't necessarily think they would do or feel a certain amount of control over them. So I do slightly understand that feeling of... you know, and J.K. Rowling's recent book, In Black Heart, is a little bit about that as well.
Yeah. Well, I've also got a comment here. I'd love to do a road trip based on the Ruth and Nelson stories, taking an Italy too. Great idea. I think maybe that's it. We should have a Goldster trip around Norfolk in Italy. How about that?
Must do it. Yes, and you could do, if you did the Brighton Mysteries, you could do Brighton as well, so you could do Brighton and Norfolk. But I have to say, I don't think this is a secret, but I'm telling you in here. I think the publishers are going to bring out in the next year or so a book called Ruth Galloway's Norfolk.
Fantastic.
So, you know, so you'll get lovely pictures of Norfolk, but also quite a lot about the settings for some of these books and the stories behind them and the Norfolk folklore. And I just want to recommend a podcast for those who like podcasts called Weird Norfolk.
Okay.
If anyone wants to look that up, it's great. And do you know what? I've written 14, now 15 books about Ruth, and I haven't really even started on how weird and strange and wonderful Norfolk is. So many stories.
And is this just an area that you know because you've holidayed there, or is it somewhere you've lived? What made you write about Ruth in Norfolk?
Well, I knew it quite well because my grandmother lived there, and my aunt Marge, who was, you know, we used to quite often have holidays in Norfolk with Aunt Marge, and she had a boat. So we used to spend quite a lot of time in her boat, and Marge was just a terrific character. And she's still with us. She's just moved. She's moved down to be near us, to the South Coast. And actually, she was the inspiration for Peggy in Postscript Murders, that the elderly lady who sits at her window and sees quite a lot. So that's Aunt Marge. So we holidayed in Norfolk quite a lot because of that. So always really fond, always really love Norfolk. But also, if you have a character who's an archaeologist, it is the county that has the most archaeology in. It's just been, it's been inhabited for a very long time. The oldest human footprints outside Africa are found in Norfolk. You know,
I did not know that. Wow.
At Haysborough, they're 800,000 years old, so they're nearly a million years old. I mean, just extraordinary. And of course, then Great Britain was attached to the rest of Europe, so you could have walked, you know.
Yes.
Basically. A little bit hazy about when those things became detached, but you know what I'm saying. So there's so much archaeology there. So that was another reason why. And it is just a place that has a lot of stories and a lot of history. And people tend to live there for a very, very long time. That's the other thing. And so you do have these sort of families who've always lived there and sort of memories, which is wonderful for a writer. Whenever I go there, people tell me amazing stories. Recently, I went there just last month, when they're researching book 15, which is called The Last Remains, I went down into a Neolithic flint mine.
How amazing.
Which was amazing.
I mean, are you just treated like an absolute celebrity in Norfolk now? Have they given you kind of the freedom of the city of Norwich? They just welcome you with red carpets because of all you've done for their tourism.
You'd like to think so, wouldn't you? No, but I would say I probably am a bit better known in Norfolk than anywhere else. So I live in Brighton, and goodness, you know, you couldn't get 10 people to come and see me in Brighton, but you do get sell out things in Norfolk because people, it's been so lovely. People have really liked the book. So I think I'm the best, I'm the most borrowed author from Norfolk Libraries. So that is something. That is an accolade I'm really proud of. So, yes, well, I haven't quite got the freedom of the city yet, though. I might have talked about that.
Well, that's very remiss of them. I mean, I don't know Norfolk well at all, and your books have genuinely made me want to go, because it does sound very beautiful. So I totally get that. Was Helen who said she wanted to do that. Absolutely. I think it's wonderful when you're reading a book and it really takes you to places. And, yeah, just I think they really should honour you for that. So you mentioned that this is the 15th book that you've written about Ruth. When is that coming out?
So that will be out. I've finished it. I'm just editing it at the moment. And it'll be out on the 2nd of February, 2023.
So you have written basically 3 books in a year. Is that right?
Sort of, if you count. Yes, I suppose so. I was going to say, if you count the Justice books, but also there's the Marple book this year. Yeah. It's almost 4. Gosh. But yes, I have been writing at least 2 a year for the last few years. So I am going to slightly, I think, slow down a little bit, but probably not that much. But
now I've heard a rumour that this might be your final Ruth Galloway book. I'm trying not to cry as I say that. Is this correct? Is that what you're thinking? Are you allowed to give us any exclusives?
Well, this is kind of, yeah. What I'm saying is it's the last for now. So it is going to be, there is going to be a pause after this one. And what it is really is that I always knew that there would be a sort of end of the story, and I didn't want to keep writing them, you know, forever and ever, really, because there is a kind of arc, there is a kind of story arc. Again, not giving anything away, but between Ruth and Nelson, and I think there's a point when that has to be, there has to be some conclusion to it. So that will happen in this book, which is called The Last Remains. Obviously, a clue in the title. So I hope it will tie up any loose ends from the series, and I hope it will be for people who have read all of them. There will be references to quite a lot of the other books in it, but I'm not saying never. You know, I can absolutely not, you know, it's not going to be anything irrevocable. I'm just saying that. And, you know, I can absolutely see myself wanting to go back and write some more in a couple of years' time. I'm absolutely not saying that, but, or I might even write a prequel, or I might write, you know, some short stories or something. So it's not the end in that way, but there is going to be a pause. I just felt, you know, as a writer, that felt the right thing to do.
And I think most writers feel that their character has reached a natural break. And quite often you can tell when people ignore that and carry on.
I think so. I think you can. And I really didn't want people, people have said, you know, I'm sad that if this is the last book, and I'm really sad if they're sad. But then again, I would hate it if they read book 16 and said, oh, they're not really as good now as they used to be.
Absolutely.
You know, you don't want that. No.
No, it's that whole thing about always leave the audience wanting more, isn't it?
Yeah, and also it's about what you want, isn't it? Because as a writer, you can only really write the things you want to write. And I used to be an editor, and I used to wish you could make writers write things, you know, because you sometimes see a gap in the market and you think, oh, I wish somebody would write that to fill that. But you can't make people, they can only write the things that they want to write. Those are the things that turn out well.
Absolutely. And so has Harbinder taken over, or will you have another detective? Are you kind of formulating ideas, or are you just going to have a complete break for a while?
No, I mean, I'll still write and I'll still publish at least a book a year, and I've got an idea for a new series. So at the moment, you'll get this Ruth book. There'll be more of the Brighton Mysteries. I'm going to carry on with those. Harbinder, I'd sort of seen her story arc end with Bleeding Heart Yard. But again, you never know. And I think some of the characters that are in Postscript Murders might turn up again. So that might happen. So what there will be books for me. So there'll be what I'm writing at the moment is book 7 in the Brighton Mysteries. And that's called, at the moment it's called, I don't know if you get this, Lucinda, but the publishers do sometimes change my titles. At the moment it's called The Great Deceiver. So that is book 7. So I'm writing that one. And I do have an idea for a new series, which I hope people will like.
And what's it like when you're coming up with a new series? Do you spend ages thinking about it, or is it something just appears and you start making notes? You plot very carefully, or just let it happen?
It's sort of a bit of both for me. I don't know about you. You're a plotter. Do you write down your plots?
I need to be a plotter. I think that's what I need to learn. I think I try to write far too much stream of consciousness, and I have learned that actually I need to plot.
It's funny, isn't it? So I sort of a little bit went the other way, because I used to write down like a chapter plan, but going all the way to the end of the book. So just one line for each chapter, but sort of I would plot it. But with Stranger Diaries, which is about 5 years ago now, maybe no less, about 4 years ago, when I was writing that, it was my most complicated plot, and it has three different points of view, and it's very complicated, but I didn't write anything down, and that sort of helped me. I think it meant that I felt a bit freer, and I was a bit able to sort of take risks with it. So from then on, the books I've written since then, I haven't had a written plan, but it is in my head. Yes. So I've maybe let myself get a little bit looser, I think, and just, you know, but because I'm quite... I tend to sort of want things to be over, and my tendency is to write quite short books, and, you know, say, oh, and then it was all over. But this has let me relax and let them go a bit longer.
Yeah, brilliant. Now, you teach writing. So this is really interesting, hearing what you've said about the whether you plot or whether you don't, that you've changed your own way of doing this. Do you want to tell people about, I'm going to put into the chat, I'm going to put in the link to West Dean College and your certificate in crime writing, because I think that's really fascinating that you've changed your own way of writing. And I just think that reflects in your course. And do you want to tell people about the course?
Of course, yes. So along with my really good friend who's been a guest on Goldster as well, Leslie Thompson, who's a terrific crime writer, if anyone doesn't know her. Leslie and I teach at West Dean College. So West Dean is in itself a really fascinating place. It's an old stately home in Chichester. And I don't know if any of you have read the Stranger Diaries, but in Stranger Diaries, there's a school that's in an old stately home, and there's a rather sinister staircase in it. And that staircase is in West Dean. So to go to West Dean, it really is there. Yeah, the staircase and the footprints on it. So it's a fascinating stately home that was once owned by this guy called Edward James, who was very into the surrealist movement. So it's full of surreal artists. So, but it's also a college, and they do lots of amazing courses if you're into things like, you know, decorative arts and instrument making and stuff like that. But they also do creative writing courses. There's a creative writing MA you can do there. But Leslie and I teach something that's called a crime writing certificate. So it's sort of midway between, you know, an actual degree and going for weekend course. So it's three weekends. And first weekend is taught by Leslie, second by me, and then the third is both of us together. And we look at crime writing, we look at character, plot, setting, how you do all that. It's also so much fun because you're in this beautiful Staley home. And if you, some ways, if you can't teach crime writing there, where can you teach it? And on the last day, we get a good friend of ours called Graham Bartlett, who is now a writer, but he was chief superintendent of Brighton and Hove. And he's advised me and lots of other authors on their police procedural, though he despairs of us a bit sometimes. basically, he's very kind and advises. So the last day, you come down to after breakfast, and there's the shape of a murdered person on the floor. You've got Chief Superintendent Graham Bartlett investigating it. He tells you when the call came in, he gives you all the clues, and you get to sort of go through a police procedure. So
that sounds so fun.
I've got to say, it's a really good course. At the end of it, you need to write a little bit. It's not terribly long, but you produce a piece of writing, and Leslie and I will read it and critique it. And if you pass, which everyone has so far, we've had some great people, you get the certificate, and you can also become a member of the CWA, the Crime Writers Association.
Fantastic. That sounds brilliant. Well, I have put the link in the chat. Got a comment here. I've been to West Dean just for the day, really beautiful. And someone else says it's one of my favourite gardens to visit. There's also a lovely cafe there. So your course is residential. Do people stay in the college?
You don't have to stay, but yes, people quite often do. So it'll be three weekends. You get to stay. Yeah. And it's like, you know, as people on here have said, it's just a beautiful place. Food is really good as well. And it's a nice bar. So it is, it just is a fun place to stay. Yeah, it really is. So it's if anyone, and there are also lots of other, if you look on the website, not just Leslie's and my course, but they do lots of creative writing courses. So if you want to write about life writing, there's a really good life writing one, and, you know, autobiography, poetry, all sorts, just have a look. So it's not just ours. Ours is the only one that's over three weekends, though, and it's a lot of fun. But there are loads of, do have a look if you're interested. There's loads of good things there.
Excellent. Well, I've put the link, everybody, in the chat. So, or you can just Google West Dean College and it'll come up. So we're almost at our end here. I'm just going to tell everybody quickly what's coming up the Agatha Christie month, and then we'll be back just in a little while. So tomorrow, you've got Humphrey talking to Vivian Kinross, who is an author and an expert on the Nile, obviously tying in with Death on the Nile. And then on Friday, he is interviewing the author Daniela Burnett, who's written a book called A Mind to Murder, which is set during a performance of The Mousetrap. Obviously, Agatha Christie's very famous long-running play. And then next week on Thursday, Humphrey is interviewing David Braun, who Ellie was talking about earlier, who is the editor of the Christie Estate books and the new Miss Marple collection. And then next Friday, I'm interviewing Jessica Fellows, who is the author of the Mitford Murders series. And then the week after that, Thursday the 29th, I'm talking to travel writer Andrew Eames, who wrote one of my favourite travel books, The 855 to Baghdad, where he followed the route that Agatha Christie used to do. For me, it was a really personal one because I've also followed that route by train, though we couldn't get as far as Baghdad. We had to end in Jordan. But it's such an incredible, evocative journey, and he writes beautifully. And then on Friday the 30th of September, we have our book of the month, and it's Agatha Christie, of course, and it is Appointment with Death. So I hope you're all reading that. It's a great one. It's a really, really fascinating story, that one. So just going back to tonight, thank you so much.
That's amazing.
Come along to all of them.
What a month. I'm going to come to some of them, definitely. Wow.
It was so fun to put together. It really was. Humphrey and I had a really great time doing it, and it's just been fascinating to see how we could take the theme and slightly run sideways with it at times.
And following her route, I think that sounds so, because one of the good things about writing about was she about Miss Marple, but of course Agatha Christie herself, she traveled a lot, didn't she? She did a lot. She just went to lots of different places, and she was a great she liked surfing, didn't she? And she liked
skating.
She was quite a woman.
Well, also her second husband was an archaeologist. So yes. How extraordinary that your husband is an archaeologist. Maybe to be a best-selling crime writer, you have to marry an archaeologist.
Well, I think archaeology and crime do quite well together. You know, I
definitely.
Think she knew her stuff about archaeology, definitely.
Well, and thank you. Monique has said about Appointment with Death, it's a really good read. So that's an inspiration for anybody. So just very quickly to end with, you've just been to the Agatha Christie Festival, haven't you? What was that like?
That was great. It was in Torquay, and I had to constantly make the joke about, what do you expect to see out of a Torquay hotel bedroom window? Herds of wildebeest, you know, that joke.
The Monty Python, the 40 Towers, yeah.
40 Towers, yeah. So, but it's a beautiful place, Torquay, and they had the International Agatha Christie Festival. So it was a bit like the month that you've put together here. Listen, there's lots of interesting things like about, there was somebody talking about how the costumes in Agatha Christie, somebody else talking about some of the historical stuff. There are plays. There are lots of people walking around in fancy dress, and you're not quite sure if they're in fancy dress or whether that's how they always dress.
But there are lots of Poirots there, people with wax and
stuff. Lots of Poirots, lots of people in sort of feathers and rather 20s-y. And there are lots of things that are put on in the evening as well. So Lucy Worsley was there talking about her new book, which centres really interestingly, talks so interestingly about the time when Agatha Christie disappeared, and
yes, of course,
the real life mystery behind that. So yes, it was a great experience, and the sun shone and Torquay looked absolutely beautiful.
Fantastic. And of course Torquay is very close to where Agatha grew up and lived. You know, so many of her books are inspired by that.
There is an evening which I couldn't get tickets for, but there is an evening at Greenway, you know, her house.
Oh yes.
Have you been there?
I've been a couple of times. It's an amazing place, actually.
There's a lovely dinner there, somebody plays the piano. I would love to, and that's setting for Dead Man's Folly, isn't it? I think
Yes.
Dead Man's Folly is set there. Yeah. So I would love to do that, but I didn't get tickets.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this evening, and have fun this evening. I know that you have a family event to go to, so do enjoy it. We've got a comment here saying, lovely to tune into this and how much they've enjoyed it. So
thank you
very, very much, everybody. Thank you for coming along. And I will see you over the next couple of weeks. And Ellie, it was great to see you again. We hope you'll come back and talk to us again when you've got yet another plethora of books out, which I'm sure will just take you a few weeks to write.
Thanks so much, Jacinda. I always love chatting to you. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for everyone who came. It's been great fun. Thank you. My sister's birthday now, nearly the same day as Agatha Christie. That's where I'm going to.
Well, enjoy it, and happy birthday to your sister. And take care.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone. Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.